I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes. I guess identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hello, this is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am your host, Liv, back with, yes, you guessed it, a conversation episode, and not just any conversation episode, it is both a returning guest and a spooky season episode, and honestly, like, one of the best things about spooky season, if you ask me, that is Scream Queens. Now, of course, we talk Scream Queens when it comes to mythology, the idea that in myth and in Greek tragedy, there are these characters, these women who we can equate with the traditional Scream Queens of modern horror slasher fix. Oh my gosh. So I spoke with Vanessa Stovall, who has been on before, and she is so wonderful, and we had so much fun and just talked modern horror movies and then ancient myths and Greek tragedy, particularly Persephone and Antigone, and how they can be seen as scream queens in relation to how we understand scream queens from modern horror. Oh my God. Really, utterly fascinating. Also, I mean, as you can tell in this episode, I will take any and every excuse to talk about movies like Scream, particularly Scream, at any given point. I
absolutely love the Scream movies. I watch them multiple times a year. They are some of my favorite movies of all time. They feel warm and fuzzy to me in a way that maybe slashers shouldn't, but they do. And so, you know, we just had so much fun connecting these to myth and to Greek tragedy and sort of seeing all the ways in which, you know, I mean, obviously this stuff is eternal, right? Like there's a reason, you know, we still love these stories. And I just love putting these kind of modern ideas, modern horror onto these ancient characters. Ugh, it was so much fun. I can't wait for you to hear it. So enjoy. Conversations. Do you like scary movies? Scream Queens of Myth with Vanessa Stovall. Straight up, I'm just so excited for, like, I mean, any spooky season episodes, but particularly, like, so we're talking Scream Queens in yes. Greek mythology, which is such a fun. I mean, basically, you sent me that message and I was like, hell yeah, abso-fucking-lutely. Like, I am a huge slasher fan. Like, Scream is my favorite movie of all time.
Beautiful.
Basically, I've seen
iconic.
It. Yes. I mean, I watch it like multiple times a year. It is like my life source. My sister and I have this whole like friendship based entirely around all of the Scream movies. I stand by all of them are great. I will love them all forever. But obviously the first one is like peak. And then the second one has Cassandra. So it's
good.
Like,
yes.
Holy shit. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. It couldn't be better. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Oh,
so excited to talk. However you have managed to interpret these women as Scream Queens, I'm so in. So please tell me.
Excited. Yeah. So yeah, very excited to be back. Very excited to talk about this very interesting, spooky topic.
Yeah.
There's actually some backstory with this one of like how Please. I got to this point. And it goes in a couple different ways. But first, for those who don't know, what a Scream Queen is, I always figure I should go over this.
No, that's good. I feel like I know the idea, but I've never tried to define it. So please.
And it is one of those sort of like tropes, archetypes that does have sort of a few different definitions / people apply it to a few different things. But in general, a Scream Queen tends to be a female protagonist from a horror film. Either a main character or sometimes like it's even just like a side character, and what they tend to be reduced down to is having a very intense scream was sort of the initial heart of it, but then it also just sort of broadly came to be more of like a deeply emotive performance in a horror film, something that was very emotionally impactful, usually in a very sort of intense way or heightened way, because it's horror, and horror is a genre of heightenedness. So general examples I tend to give people, Neve Campbell in Scream, there we go.
Obviously.
Iconic,
right.
Great. But people would even say Drew Barrymore at the beginning of Scream.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, because she kind of sets it all up. It's the best thing about Scream, certainly, like, you know, the first time you see it, and, you know, especially if you saw it back in the day, like, I wouldn't have seen it when it came out because it came out in 96. So I was like 8. Thank God I was a little young. But, you know, I definitely saw it, like, still in the 90s, you know, and in that time frame of Drew Barrymore's height. But, like, she comes in and you think, like, she's on the front poster. Mm-hmm. So you think, like, oh, this movie is starring Drew Barrymore. She is huge. She is, like, it. And then it starts with her and, you know, she's dead in the first 10 minutes. And she's dead in that. I mean, I actually watched that scene just last night. Literally just watched Drew Barrymore do this. And it's one of my favorite scenes ever. But it's so perfect because she really dies in that like most iconic kind of way. And then it's like, oh, nope, Drew Barrymore's not in this anymore. And I absolutely love that fake out. I'm going to try not to make this episode about Scream.
No, here we are, I mean, so far. It's such a like, I mean, that's why I brought it up first. Because Scream is such a great example. Especially as I get into later, you guys might sort of, especially what I was talking about last time I was on the show, I have a lot of feelings about Greek tragedy and horror. But especially, I think a lot of the ways in which horror operates as a genre, especially around social commentary, and Scream is such a good example of that, because it's like such a good parodying of the horror genre, but also like leaning in to sort of make this kind of new branch of horror going forward. And it's so good.
Like, it is so good. But yeah, I mean, I'm going to do it again. But that is what I love so much about Scream, is that in itself, in its like, as a whole, it is its own good horror movie, but it is also playing with tropes of horror movies very intentionally and like very well, you know, like they're, it's really making some good, like it just, it does so many things and it does them all so well. And I fucking love this movie. But certainly like Scream Queens 2, and I'm sure you're about to get to this, but I want to make sure it's clear that I also acknowledge this. But like Jamie Lee Curtis is sort of the accepted like original Scream Queen.
Well, and actually, yeah, I would contest that. She's the second.
Oh, the second. Okay.
I would actually contest that Jamie Lee Curtis is sort of like the first known Scream Queen. I would definitely say of like what we know of the horror genre today, like especially her plus John Carpenter, that like whole score. But to take it back to an earlier filmmaker who was also very known for his psychology and score, Janet Leigh in Hitchcock's films was definitely known as one of the most iconic first Scream Queens, especially in Psycho. Speaking again of that trip out, someone dying early on, who is like sort of thought to be the main character of this film, and then having to go through the aftermath of that again.
Well, and that's Jamie Lee Curtis's mother.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I literally forgot that.
Okay. And I would have forgotten it too, except last night I saw that I was scrolling on Twitter and somehow it came up. And so I guess there's a new Halloween movie, and Jamie Lee Curtis went to the premiere dressed as her mother in Psycho.
That is amazing. Oh my gosh. No, now I'm so sad, because that would have been such a better segue of just like, actually, it was an earlier, her mother instead of
yeah,
like
yeah, her mom
filmmaker.
Did it first.
Oh God. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, God, Psycho is so classic. And I suppose when it comes to Jamie Lee Curtis, she's just sort of the like acknowledged, like the quote unquote Scream Queen. But yeah, definitely. I mean, Psycho would have been, I mean, the first original. And then I'm sure there's like, I suppose Exorcist doesn't really have anyone that would kind of qualify as that. I'm just thinking
not,
of like classic.
Not as much, yeah, in that sense. But I think the term definitely then started getting like tweaked more. Like, I think it gets conflated a lot with like the idea of the final girl, which for those who don't know, the final girl is sort of this like trope in horror of like, there's always going to be one girl at the end. So, you know, you're killing off everyone to get to that. But also I would say many final girls are scream queens. Not all scream queens are final girls, because oftentimes a scream queen is just a great side character. But I definitely think, yeah, there's this interesting turn, towards like the more emotional, I'd say, in like going to aughts 2010s horror movie, going onward. Like, I think my first Scream Queen that, like, deeply freaked me out as a kid is when I saw Naomi Watts in The Ring, which I was just like, not just because it was set where I grew up in Seattle and the peninsula. I was very stressed about that. But because it is this very deep sort of, like, psychological tale about a woman just trying to understand things and like trying to empathize with these like unknown forces that are impacting her, even if they're threatening her life and the lives of her loved ones.
Okay, so I watched that earlier this week or last week. This is my month where I just like take it all in, especially ones that are like nostalgic for me, because The Ring, I think it came out in like 2002. I looked it up. So I was like 14. It was like, oh my God, it was like the horror movie of my, you know, middle school years. Yeah. And it was so scary, and it was so much, but I was so curious. Like I tweeted out, you know, how much does The Ring hold up to people today who don't have those, who never had those enormous TVs, who didn't have VHS.
Oh, like, real, yeah.
Right? Like, know that feeling of putting a VHS into your, like,
or even, you know, just like the sense of like the TV, like Black Mirror, which is actually coined first by Arcade Fire. I just like to say the Black Mirror show creators say it, they named their show after the song by Arcade Fire, which came out in 2005.
Or Canadians six. Represent.
Yeah, I know. I'm just like
legally obligated. Arcade Fire,
on their album Neon Canadians. Bible. I love that song. Yeah. This idea of like the TV and like this like big box TV as mm-hmm. this weird sort of like mirror almost into
well and the snow of a TV, right? Like the
yeah
when your mm-hmm. VHS ends mm-hmm. and it's just mm-hmm. snow, like that doesn't happen anymore. Your TV goes blue and then suddenly your, you know, home has this like yeah, obnoxious yeah. blue light,
or it goes but back like, to the PS5
like, yeah you're screen. Yeah, go, yeah. alters like enters a screensaver, you know, my Apple will start showing me beautiful landscapes and you're like okay. But yeah, that idea of like the and the snow and the sound it would make, you know, it might wake you up if you fell asleep yeah. watching TV.
Oh, you're so or, right. Yeah.
Right? All of these mm-hmm. things that are mm-hmm. so tied to that time period in such a fascinating way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting thinking about it now, too, because I remember watching it, like, when it came out. Actually, my sister was the same age as you, so she was just like, watch this horror movie. Yeah, The Ring is such an interesting one. The Ring was like my only Northwest representation for like 3 years until Twilight came out. So like those were like my two like big of just like
incredible comparison.
Yeah, absolutely. Ghosts and vampires. Yeah. I was just like, yeah, that checks. That's the Northwest. But now it's like I'm having to do all this work again on Twilight because of Persephone. Because Meyer decided to weave the Persephone myth into Midnight Sun. There's some good fruit to mine out of it, especially around like I think Persephone and like young female identity. Actually, let me segue please. Right here. This is a good segue to explain how I'm going to talk about Persephone right now, because I just need to make a statement about Persephone just in general. It's one I've been trying to make a lot in my research over the past couple years, because I'm just like, everybody, yes, Persephone is a hot topic. She represents many things. I would encourage everyone, though, who really loves engaging with her and dealing with her. And I say this as someone who had to go through this entire process myself, to really interrogate why. Because I think there's usually when people study Persephone, I'm just like, why? And then I learn so much about that person. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot that people try to inscribe onto Persephone. And it's not just because she has so many different versions of her myth, mm-hmm. but because I think she represents an intersection of a lot of different, very difficult things about culture, family, society, ourselves, etc. The identity, mm-hmm. the self versus like community versus like who we are to family versus who we are to partners versus, you know, how we deal in power systems, how we react when different aspects are enacted against us, etc., etc. But I think there got a point to me in undergrad where I was arguing a lot of different things about Persephone in my research. And I was just like, feel like a lot of this is coming from like a very personal place actually. And I think I got to a point, especially like reading a lot online of different ways people were interpreting Persephone, I actually got kind of defensive about her, especially a lot of the ways in which people were trying to talk about like agency and consent around her myths a lot, mm-hmm. Because there was one aspect that I feel gets overlooked quite a bit about Persephone, which is that in every version of her myth, she does the exact same thing when she's taken to the underworld. She screams, and it's a very intense scream. It's mm-hmm. actually like one of the more intense sonic events in Greek mythology in general.
That's so true. I can't think of another example where, you know, because the whole thing about her scream is that it's heard far and wide.
Very and like, far and wide.
Like it is that it's that Hecate hears it. And that's why mm-hmm. she has the information to give to Demeter, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm. It's a fascinating scream because it's one that it is noted that like nymphs and mortals like don't hear it for some reason. So there is this like interesting sonic effect. But then it mm-hmm. is heard by Hecate deep in her cave. It's sort of heard by like Helios, but he also just sees everything.
He's just kind of there yeah. all the time.
Yeah. And then the echo of it, because then it sort of goes into how the mountains and like the whole of like the earth just start like resounding and echoing like the sound back. It's the echo that actually travels to Demeter that she hears and then starts running, sees Hecate, and they're both just like, oh god, we heard this thing, but like we didn't see what happened, so like we need more information. And it's that scream that sort of like catapults like the entire action of like that myth. The scream is very intense, and so it's actually what I started returning to when I was starting to think about screams a bit more in antiquity. Because I started looking at Greek tragedy sort of first, where I was like, oh, there's all these figures like Io, Cassandra, like these really great big lamenters, wailers that do like a lot. Electra. But then I was just like, right, Greek tragedy is like playing on so many of these past narratives and these past like older myths and sort of how they like over time impact this larger network. So I started going back to archaic myth and sort of looking at these big utterances. And yeah, Persephone is such an intense one. And like, it's not just in her different myths. It's even connected to a lot of like the religious practices around her too. So like the Eleusinian Mysteries, which were the religious rites for her and her mother Demeter through like Athens and Eleusis, there was this huge procession that would move from Athens to Eleusis to do the mysteries before folks would come back. And it's often talked about how like sonic and like loud this like procession was, to the extent there's even like an anecdote in Herodotus where he talks about how there was an army and like they're coming to Athens to fight, but then like they see this like far off cloud just sort of like getting bigger and they're like, well, what the hell is that? And then they just hear like the procession like as it's like going to Eleusis, and they're just like, well, that's something to do with the gods. Maybe we should back off. Like,
yeah, we're out.
A little creepy. So you do get these sort of like resonances of especially like sound and like lamenting with Persephone. And a lot of this like dovetails into my own research. I study sound a lot, so I'm always trying to get at the gods from a more sonic point. And Persephone is an interesting one. There's a lot of like, you can't talk about her rites. She has a lot of mysterious names and goes through a bunch of different naming. Actually, as we'll see in Antigone, she has one of her weirder names in that one. And she also just like is known for being the person you're supposed to go to in the underworld for hearing your pleas or like to go about like a better life or for different things. Like all these different heroes go to her for different reasons. Heracles is like, ah, yo, cousin, I need to fight this dog. Can I do it? Psyche goes to her for a box for Venus over in Roman myth. Oh, apparently, like, the most intense, empathetic, emotive concert in history was played for her and Hades in the sense of Orpheus coming down there. So there is, like, a lot of interesting, like, sound-related stuff, and especially, like, in, like, sort of the cacophonic soundscape that I started getting interested in a lot more, because I think you hear a lot of these, like, strange, cacophonic, sort of otherworldly sounds emerging a lot in Greek tragedy, especially when you get, like, the Furies and, like, all these different gorgonic sort of creatures that are supposed to also be represented by the aulos, which is the instrument of the theater, and the sort of, like, hissing, almost, like, bagpipe oboe. It's hard to describe the aulos. It's like a bagpipe oboe, sort of sounding like. So yeah, that sort of was like the push to get me to think about like Persephone as this sort of like, I guess, like proto scream queen of like myth. And then like once we get into Greek tragedy, we get these like very traditional in these like tragedies that I see as horror narratives, different types of scream queens coming about.
I love that.
Just say a few spooky things about Persephone.
Oh yeah, nice, please.
She's like creepy. And I want people to give her creepy do a bit more.
She's the dread goddess.
Yeah, I'm just like, guys, remember that phase? By guys, I mean just like, you know, folks raised and socialized as women. Like, remember that phase we all went through when we were obsessed with like murder and morbid shit? That's what Persephone is. Like, I think that's basically my thesis on her.
Yeah. I get that.
But even, like, the first time she shows up in written sources in Homer's Odyssey, Like, it's super creepy. Like, it's when Odysseus is, like, trying to talk to the dead, to talk to Tiresias to get more information. Tiresias will also pop up later in Antigone, too. And, like, but before he can go, like, Persephone is just, like, sending all of these women, like, from, like, tragedy and, like, myth who have, like, died to Odysseus to just, like...
I fucking love that part.
...give their testimony. And it's a lot. It's, like, a very ghouly scene. It's very, like, intense. It's wonderful. But also she's just, like, yeah, the sort of, like, interesting sort of background, like, very spectral, almost kind of, like, haunting figure. And she, even, like, in her initial myth, though, this is something that I love touching on with folks more, all of the, like, flowers that she's gathering are all, like, myths of men who've died, for the most part, or, like, heroes that, like, have passed.
Oh, shit.
Like, roses are often associated with Adonis who falls, hyacinth yeah. with Hyacinthus. The
crocuses
Narcissus.
Are somebody too, right? Crocus, oh yeah, Narcissus, yeah, and then
well,
crocus is one.
Violets with Atthis, yeah. So there's lots of. So she's like gathering all of these like traditionally like dying, going to the earth, coming back, men right before she herself is about to be taken alive into death, essentially before she comes back.
Yeah.
So and yeah, there's just like all these ideas of you know going to death, returning from death, you know. She is kind of like the Eleusinian mysteries were one of the bigger, like eschatological, which is all like afterlife oriented religions before like Christianity became a very big one. Like, but yeah, no, Persephone was sort of like the person you would come to terms with as you die, and but also could potentially come back to life in a different way. And so, yeah, she's, you know, creepy. We love her.
Yeah, she's the true crime podcast loving young woman.
Yeah. And she tends to be like, she's often not a mother, but when she is, they tend to be of like really intense things, like the Furies in Orphic hymn tradition. Or, you know, she's often thought of in different senses of Dionysian ritual to be the mother of Dionysus or Iacchus or Zagreus. Before he's torn apart and then has to be reborn again.
That's all Orphic too, right? Mm-hmm. Orphic
yeah.
really like...
And Orphic, yeah, it loops yeah. around in as well.
Yeah, interesting. Because I know, like, I've, you know, every time people ask me about Zagreus, I'm like, he's Orphic, I don't know, sorry. I know he's in the video game Hades, but I don't know Orphic mythology.
But also, like, I want to tell people, like, even though I'm going on about, like, the creepiness, etc., good deal of horror is like commentary in different way and using different types of emotions to do so. So even though I love the Homeric hymn to Demeter and see it as this like maybe much more horror oriented hymn, a lot of the ways in which this horror is accomplished is actually through humor in different ways. And like the ways in which humor gets utilized like throughout the myth, like really helps sort of like highlight the differences and disparities between gods and mortals. One of my favorite episodes in the entire hymn is just when Demeter gets caught trying to turn Demophon into an immortal, and it's like three or four lines of like how angry she is at like Demophon's mom Metanira before she speaks, but like right before she speaks for like half a line it's like, oh yeah, and then she like tossed the baby to the ground and you're like, what? Like, but then she just goes on this like long tirade of just like, yeah. What the hell, woman? Like, how dare you question me putting your child in the fire? Like, all this stuff. Like, you're going to regret it. Like, disappears. And then it's like, Metanira's like, kneeling there. Her knees buckle. And it's just like, she's, like, so in shock that, like, she can't even hear, like, the cries of her child on the ground.
I mean, but imagine having a goddess, like, you think this is, like, old woman who's been hanging out in your house. And then she transforms into a goddess and then some and starts screaming at you for fucking everything up. Like,
but it's like,
that'd be some stressful shit.
It's really stressful. But I was just like, I really got caught on the comedy of it all. Of just like, God, this is so like intense. But I'm just like, Demeter, the thing you do right before like dragging this woman is you throw her baby on the ground.
Yeah. And but also you like... We're putting him in the fire, and then you think that this woman is overreacting by, like, being annoyed that you're putting her baby in the fire.
And like, it is so great because it's, like, this hymn is all about grief and the relationships between parents and their children, and like how these emotions come about in big and intense ways. I love that episode because it's just, I mean, the horror of it is so real. Like if you're Met and Ira, like coming into like, you know, this room and being like, my child is in the fire. Like, of course, like, you know, but it turns into this very comedic scene because of like who the gods are, their nature, et cetera. And so with that note, I would like to transition into the ways in which I think this form gets sort of taken to the next level in Greek tragedy, which is something that, yeah, what a beautiful medium, what a beautiful genre to express all of these things. And often goes between so many different emotions to try to build this sort of huge, I want to say sympathy. But when I say sympathy, I don't mean in the traditional sense. I don't mean in the stoic cosmic sympathy sense. I mean in a like just genuine like bringing all of the pathos, all of the feelings together, like in this huge, thinking of symphony, actually. You know, for me being in symphony growing up, that was always, you know, bring all these voices of different instruments together until we could create this like much richer symphonic narrative. And I feel like that's sort of what Greek tragedy does. It brings all these different types of emotions together to like create this much more heightened narrative with help of acting and music and things like that. So I would like to talk about the scream queen, the iconic woman from Greek tragedy, the emotive, wonderful Antigone. She's so great. I love her. I love her maybe too much because it's just a perfect play. And I don't say that about many plays because I am a playwright, but I remember reading Antigone for the first time and being like, oh, I need to learn Greek because I need to read this play in Greek. And I remember reading Antigone in Greek for the first time. And I was just like, okay, Sophocles is on to something, but what is it? Actually, I guess I should ask. Have you ever talked about Antigone on the show?
Not enough.
Yo, all right.
I know. I know. So I've told the story of Oedipus and the aftermath and all of that, but it was also really early in the show. And then the closest I've gotten was that I chose, because I'm a Euripides girl, I went with the Phoenician women.
Ooh, I love that version. It's a good one.
Yeah, it is. And so it kind of incorporates like everything. And I was able to really put an emphasis on Jocasta because I feel like Antigone gets a lot of pop culture emphasis that Jocasta deserves some of. But yeah, all to say, no, I haven't gone into the play. I do intend to. I do intend to.
It's spectacular.
Yeah. I've read it, but not since university. So it's been so long. I need to read it again.
It's really like, I think the thing about Antigone, I think this actually helps with like what you've already talked about on the show, giving it the framing. The play Antigone is such a like diversion from myth, but it also like deeply impacts everything that happens ever after it. Because yeah, Antigone is kind of just like a minor character that Sophocles decided to write a giant play about. And this is sort of like the version that everyone now takes as canon, even though it's like very, we have other versions around this play from, it was very, very popular. It was one of the big Theban cycles that everyone loved doing. And Antigone is actually the first Theban play that Sophocles wrote. So chronologically, it actually comes last of the other two, Oedipus Rex and Oedipus at Colonus. But he wrote it first, and actually around the same time that, actually might have been the same year, that Euripides wrote Alcestis. So I actually see a lot of, there's a lot of very interesting similarities in those plays, especially around like women having to go to the underworld or like offstage and whether or not they get released from that in different ways.
Oh, I need to cover Alcestis too. I haven't covered that on the show.
Oh, Alcestis writing is it also down. Great. Wait, yeah. Call me back for Alcestis. I love Alcestis. Okay. But yeah, I'll give a brief overview of Antigone for those who don't know. So, Oedipus bangs his mom. We all know this. bad things happen because of it. Finds out, blinds himself. Jocasta finds out, hangs herself. It's really sad. And then their sons, Eteocles and Polynices, they are given the throne of Thebes and they are told they have to switch off every year for it. Why is this always a thing in Greek. They did the same thing with like Thyestes and Atreus as well.
Oh, I'm yeah. Like, I was going to say, like, who else did they do this mm-hmm, with? But yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm just like, stop. Mm-hmm. Give them different kingdoms. Like,
yeah. Like, God. This is not going to go well
mm-hmm, at all.
Cursed families.
It never
and whatever.
Does.
No.
Especially. It's such a trope.
We got a couple cursed lines in Greek myth. And guess what? It's the two of them.
Yeah. And so naturally, one brother, Eteocles, decides to seize the throne, banishes his brother Polynices. Polynices is exiled, goes, marries a foreign princess, raises an army against Thebes, brings them back, and so it ends up being this giant, huge conflict.
You might call it a seven against Thebes.
Yes. Aeschylus might call it a seven against Thebes. Yes, this is known for Thebes has seven gates. There were seven captains. Polynices leads at seven against Thebes, which really means seven armies. It's intense. Lots of fighting. It's very dramatic. This is like one of the bigger like war things people love other than like the Iliad. And so, of course, it comes down to both the brothers, after all their captains are dead, fighting one-on-one combat against each other. They both kill each other. And so they're both dead. And it's really horrifying and sad. Meanwhile, they're family members are basically what happens later for the events of the Antigone. And this is one that we don't actually know specifically if this is an event that Sophocles is explicitly stating. They reference, like, in part that one of the sons has died. But we don't know if he's, like, directly using this motif in the way that, like, Aeschylus did, which mm-hmm. is that the cousin of Polynices and Eteocles, named Megaris, who is Creon's son, their uncle Creon. Megaris, it's said that he has to be sacrificed. And in many versions, it's Tiresias, actually, who says that, like, kid has to be sacrificed, then, like, everything will be over. So there is this, like, very sad sort of, like, background, too, of, like, even, like, one of their cousins has to be killed for them to stop fighting. And then, like, you know, they do stop fighting, but, like, they die, too. So there's a lot of intense grief. So Creon, their uncle, as the eldest male relative, then gets the throne that night as they all die. And it's really sad. And he decrees that Eteocles, so like the brother who'd seized the throne, the brother who was, you know, king of Thebes, that he would get a proper burial. But Polynices, the brother who was pushed off the throne and who came back and attacked the city with an army, that his body would be left to rot and just become food for dogs and birds, he actually says. And so the play Antigone begins just before dawn, after this horrible night where all the stuff has happened, everyone's died. And it's the sisters of Polynices and Eteocles. They come outside of the palace, Antigone and Ismene. And quick note, they have interesting names. Ismene is, like, very close to the Ismenes, which is, like, one of the main rivers that flows through Thebes. So she has this very, like, watery river, like, you know, but part of the people, the city quality. Antigone, her name literally means against birth, or sort of, like, ooh, against generation. Many have read into this in a lot of different ways. Actually, I would say Antigone shares quite a bit with Persephone in that way, in that a lot of attention has been paid to her through reception, through scholarship, through history, through philosophy, through psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. And I think it often reveals a lot more about people who are studying her than perhaps the play itself. And I would say that that's actually a viewpoint that's much wider accepted about Antigone. She's kind of known as being like the one everyone does to death because there's so much to talk about with her because it is such an intense and involved play.
That's why I chose to go with the Phoenician women instead. Mm-hmm, also mm-hmm. because it kind of combined Seven Against Thebes with Antigone in an interesting way. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, right? She's so overdone, but that doesn't make her less interesting.
Not at all. Yeah. And it's especially yeah. like this version that is so overdone and even actually seemed to impact even some of our own versions that we have of the play. Mm. Seven Against Thebes specifically. It's thought that the ending of it is actually spurious or was rewritten at a later point to help like make the play like a transition into like the Antigone better. Because there is kind of like this random scene where Antigone just like pops up at the end. She's like, well, I'm gonna bury them no matter what my like uncle says, and like like makes it known. And like that's like the end of the play, and you're like, what? Like, where did that come from?
Interesting.
Yeah, it is this very interesting impact that Sophocles has had through this character. We get these two sisters who I will actually argue both are scream queens. And people might be surprised that I would say that about Ismene, but people also might be surprised that I would say that about Antigone. So I'll dive in after I get through the plots. Basically, Antigone is just like, yo, sis, did you hear about Creon? This is whack. Like, our brothers both need to be buried. This is messed up. And Ismene is pretty much just like, I agree, but like, what? We have no power. Like, he's the king now. We just have to do this. It sucks. I'm sorry. And Antigone's like, I'm gonna do it anyway. Love you, bye. And Ismene's like, damn, that is foolish, but also love you, bye. I actually really like the way Sophocles writes sisters. I think he either had two sisters or just had like two sisters around that he observed a lot. So there's like a lot in their back and forth. But also in his Electra too, that I'm just like, you know way too much about how sisters talk to each other. I'm a little disturbed. then sort of like the day breaks, and the chorus of this play is all old men. I mean, it's all the old men of the city. And they're very sort of empathetic to their new leader, Creon, because they're just like, wow. Yesterday was wild. Like, we just went through war. We're really stressed. Like, we're really happy. Like, we have a leader who can sort of bring us through a lot. And Creon is sort of one of those, like, big figures from Greek tragedy. He's known for being a lot. A lot of people compare him to Pentheus of the Bacchae because I think they go through a lot of similar experiences, especially around wanting to imprison women in different ways for different reasons. But Creon is also, I think, one of the most impressive characters from Greek tragedy. And it's, I always have to like tell people, he's on stage for over 2/3 of the play, and he has the majority of the dialogue. For contrast, Antigone is on stage for less than 1/3 of the play and has like not nearly as much dialogue as he does.
That's very Iphigenia Aulis.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, very, very Iphigenia Aulis. I would agree. And a lot of people even ask, like, why isn't this name Creon? Like, this, it's kind of his show. And hopefully I will answer that with a horror lens. But he's very, I think there tends to be a lot of, like, is Creon right? Is Antigone right? Like, in these, like, different things. I'm like, the two people going through intense emotional responses. And I think that is what we first have to recognize, because they say it quite a bit. But I would also like to point out, Creon has an eerie similarity, I would say, with a lot of more contemporary American politicians in very different ways. Like, one of his like earliest lines is he's just like, these are the laws, like, by which, like, I'm going to make Thebes great again. Like, pretty much. And you're just like, ooh, buddy. Ooh. And actually, even last summer, as things were popping off, well, in summer of 2020, I actually wrote like a long piece critiquing here in New York, Bill de Blasio and Andrew Cuomo, because I was just like, you guys are, this is very Creon-esque, what is happening in the city and state right now, and especially how you guys tend to be ignoring a lot of the factors. And I think, in that sense, that's where I sort of see Creon as a character. He's deeply empathetic, but he ignores a lot of very basic things that are happening in the city, all because he wants to have this very intense power over, like, defining bodies. And the definition of bodies is sort of all of what the Antigone is about, because Creon is trying to be like, ah, this dead body is worthy of such treatment. This dead body is worthy of X treatment. And you have his niece, Antigone, basically saying the entire time, I disagree. Like, actually, no, they're both worthy of equal treatment because, like, they are corpses. And they go through so many different levels, basically fighting this point, because Creon's just like, all right, here are my rules. I'm the leader. This is what's going to happen. What happens immediately? Antigone buries her brother, or like tries to, at least, like putting stuff mm-hmm. around him before she is taken away by guards to be interrogated about this thing. And the entire play is them arguing about this fact, but also how entangled their relationships are with each other and what is like worth and meaning during these times. Because Antigone is not only his niece, she's also going to be the person who's supposed to carry forth his line because she's actually engaged to his son, Paimon. Yeah, so he has like a lot of anxiety of just like, like my son, like my offspring cannot come from like this evil woman. Like I have to kill her. He gets very intense. He even threatens Ismene at one point too, because he's just like, well, Antigone's not having the response I want. Let's bring out Ismene, because she's going to have this like, you know, intense, she's going to heighten the terror of the scene because Antigone is giving him nothing. And it's actually in the scene where Creon brings Ismene out of the palace to basically like harass her in front of Antigone. That I argue is why Ismene is such a powerful scream queen in the play, because she really does like heighten the terror, but she also makes the stakes clear throughout it. Like she tries to ally herself with her sister, and her sister's like, no, like we should not have two people punished for like the one thing I'm doing. Also, you didn't even want to do it. This doesn't make sense. But at the same time, Ismene then like directly poses all of the questions to Creon of just like, are you going to kill your wife's like fiance? Are you going to make him like deal with all these things? And Creon has some of his worst lines in the play in response to Ismene. Like when she's just like, you're going to get rid of your like son's wife. He's just like, there are other furrows for his plow. And you're like, God damn. Yeah, no, he gets like really intense, like very misogynistic. Like he talks about like how like they both need to go back into the house so that like they can return to being women, because he like calls them animals while they're out there and stuff like that. Like he gets very, very nasty like once Ismene comes out. And so that's where I argue she has such an intense like emotional push, because she also is the one person to basically like break through Antigone's like anger and her like rhetoric. And actually make Antigone freak out and be like, no, you will not die with me. Absolutely not. Like, I will fight you. Like, if you try to do that, because you need to live. I'm going to die. Like, no, no. And then we get Paimon, Creon's son, coming out and just being like, Dad, I think you're losing it. Like, he's just like, I'm stressed. Like, I just want you to have good judgment. I really don't think you have good judgment right now, because the city is on Antigone's side. And like, I think we should actually listen to this. And Creon loses it against his son. And in fact, it's like, I'm going to kill Antigone right here in front of you to teach you a lesson. And Haimon's like, no, absolutely not. Bye. I'm a leave. Like, no, like, actually, you don't have power over this. Like, peace out. I'm leaving. And it's actually the point where, like, Haimon physically removes himself from the stage. And it expresses this in a way that, like, Creon's been able to control everyone else on the stage at this point, that Creon's just like, I can't kill her. Like, I have to like literally imprison her, like put her in a tomb, like just go put her on the edges of town, exile, put her in a hole. But he very specifically notes that he is going to leave food there for her, which was part of actually like the ancient custom around imprisonment, is that you really needed to like leave food for like a person who's imprisoned, otherwise like they probably would not get fed. This is actually noted in some of the anecdotes about the Athenian prison, which was at the contemporary time of Sophocles, of like you really needed like family members or like friends who were going to feed you if you were in prison. But he says like, I'm gonna leave like enough food so that like the city won't be stained by like the disgrace of us just like leaving a girl in the ground. And so he like sends her off, and she actually like laments herself. She like sings herself to her prison grave. And like he hates that too. He's just like, stop, wait, run faster. He's like, go, like people are gonna keep singing like until, you know, because she doesn't want to actually go to prison. And it's only finally when she's imprisoned that Tiresias, that old man, comes, and he's just like, hey, so there's a plague, by the way, in the city, because you left a body out, and it's bad, so we need to do something about this. And Creon literally still is just like, no, I don't care if Zeus's eagle comes and grabs like a Polynices's body. Like, we are not burying it. None of this is happening. You're just a greedy old man who's just like convinced from gold from the east, clearly. And it's like he goes off the deep end. And Tiresias is just like, you know what? No, I don't know. Screw you. Here's a goddamn prophecy. Before the night is up, you're going to have to exchange a corpse for a corpse, and probably your whole house is going to die. Bye. I am so done with you. And it's only at that point that Creon's like, hey, Chorus. The Chorus is like, yeah? And he's like, so Tiresias has never really been wrong about prophecies? And the Chorus is like, yeah. Nah, like, since we were kids, he's never been wrong.
And he's really
like,
good.
Yeah. And Creon's like, shit. Okay, maybe I should go release her.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have like one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, right. Which is different than empathy, yeah. Right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
And it is, of course, at this moment where Creon realizes that he's been in the wrong and must right things, that it is too late. And we cannot. A messenger comes to tell the Chorus that Antigone is dead. Haemon is also dead because when Creon got to the tomb, after he did make sure to bury Polynices on his way there, they do know. He gets to the tomb and he hears just like wailing, like coming from inside. And he's just like, oh my God, that sounds like my son. And he goes in and he sees Haemon basically like, hanging on to Antigone, who hung herself with her own like linen in the cave prison tomb. It has a few different names. So I'm always like cave, prison tomb, bed chamber. It's all these things. And he's just like, oh God. He's like, wow, this is bad. And he's also like, don't hug a corpse. Like, son, come on. Like, ah. And Haimon, of course, like, is beyond, he literally says he's like beyond words. Like, there's just an energy in his eye. And he tries to kill his dad, fails, and then stabs himself because he's just gone and done. And so the messenger is telling Chorus this. Meanwhile, Eurydice, who is Creon's wife, different Eurydice, there are a few Eurydices in myth, comes out and she's just like, hi. She hasn't made any appearance. She has the shortest like speech in all of Greek tragedy. It's only 6 lines. She's just like, hi, I just came out to like check the doors. Like, what's going on? I feel like I heard something about my son. And the messenger's like, yo, he's dead. This is stressful, etc. And she says nothing and goes inside. And Chorus is like, oh no, is she okay? Like, ah. And the messenger's like, let me go check on her. And then like Creon comes in. He's singing, he's lamenting, he's carrying Haimon's dead body. He's just like, I'm a lifeless corpse. This is terrible. Oh my God. Everything terrible has happened. And then the messenger comes out from the house and is like, your wife just hung herself too. Like, she's dead. Actually, I think she did stab herself. Don't quote me on that. Well, it's actually important to note because hanging versus stabbing is actually means a lot based on what your female role in society is in Greek tragedy. Mm. So actually, I think it is, she does stab herself and that is noteworthy.
Right.
Yeah, mothers tend to hang themselves. Young girls tend to be sacrificed and or stabbed. And so Creon has lost his whole family. He has no way of having more kids, like his wife's dead too. It's terrible. And actually, this is a point that I like, is that in a lot of Antigone's actions, and explicitly when it comes to her sister, Antigone is actually finagled things so that Ismene is essentially the final girl of the play. Mm-hmm. She just never comes back after she's sent back in the house, but it's like she technically is like alive, like narratively speaking. Yeah. So despite like everything that has happened, like, and all this death and stuff, like there is still Ismene who has survived in different ways. So that was a very long sort of overview of Antigone, but this play, which I love so much, and I originally first got interested in it during my master's because I was writing a paper on Antigone and imprisonment, because I thought it was such an interesting example from myth of like a gal who's imprisoned for like basically like what she's saying versus like, I'm scared you're gonna have this baby. And so I was like, this is so fascinating. I was like, I need to learn more about like imprisonment in antiquity, which took me on a long spiral. I actually learned we have no accounts of like any women in prisons from antiquity, like from their own point of view, especially. Like there's a few anecdotes. We know that women were in prison, but we just don't get a whole lot of like actual historical stories about it. And almost exclusively, they tend to come from myth. And so I was like really interested in sort of like these ideas of sort of like binding and unbinding. And a lot of this was because I wrote my thesis under the influence of Marcus Fulch at Columbia, who's writing a book right now on imprisonment in antiquity. And a lot of what he notes, especially from motifs around goddesses bound in archaic myth, is that the binding and unbinding of a goddess tends to signal, or even different figures, tends to signal like regime change in myth. And so like we see this a lot in the Theogony with like, you know, Gaia is being bound, like her like children are being shoved into her and like they're not being able to be released. When Zeus releases, you know, the giants and the hundred hand folk, like you have this regime change of Zeus taking over, etc. But like even also like Zeus, like with Cronos and like, you know, releasing all of his siblings from Cronos's stomach, like you see this release from this like idea of imprisonment and regime change coming about. Athena bursting through Zeus's head, you know, to like, as like a weird sort of like middle ground between her and Maedus, you see this, like, again, like, shift in different types of regime change that often comes with binding and unbinding. Homeric hymn to Demeter, we see one of the biggest regime changes and things happening with the binding and unbinding of Persephone. And so I bring all of this up to talk about the fact that, like, Antigone is so fascinating because, like, she's not able to be unbound. Like, Creon isn't able to release her, and then, like, a change in regime happens. In fact, it's something, like, much, much more kind of inverted happens away from that. And I became obsessed with this turn and trying to sort of think through why I found it so fascinating. I think it's because Creon is such an intense presence on that stage. Even in my thesis, I think I, like, referred to him as, like, a stage manager because he keeps just, like, trying to organize everything that is happening from it. From an intense physical standpoint, too. Like, he talks about things very, very, very physically. And there is such, like, a physical, somatic, like, very bodied presence that he brings to the stage. But also trying to, like, control the bodily functions of other folks as well. Who can talk and who can't talk. Who can have sex with who and who can't. And then in the end, when he imprisons Antigone, like, he is really trying to control her mouth in a very specific way of just, like, you will eat this thing while I imprison you. So I started thinking about, because Antigone can't have, like, a strong physical in the traditional impact, she doesn't have a strong physical presence throughout the play. I started thinking more, I guess, along the lines of, like, her psychological presence, but less, I think, in the terms of, like, modern psychology, more thinking through, like, the psyche in the more ancient sense, the psuche, the, like, spirit, the soul in other senses, but also just sort of thinking about these ideas of, like, soul and spirit, because they are very, like, connected with especially ancient eschatological myths, especially with Persephone, which, like, you know, there's a lot of chthonic influence in the Antigone and the chthonic gods and honoring them and wanting to hold their honor.
Even just, like, being locked away in a cave as the sort of main point feels very chthonic. I mean,
yeah,
somewhat is, but yeah.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And it's like there's so much, like, back and forth between her and Creon, where she's always defining, like, the gods, like, especially, like, the gods below as, like, the main gods that she's, like, really clued into and, like, talking about. She's a very chthonic figure, very into, like, chthonic myth. Actually, I think there's, if anyone wants to do a paper on Antigone and Orphism, that should probably be explored more. I'm gonna just throw that out there because I'm too late.
Yeah. I also just want to say, because I'm not sure how much I've emphasized what the word chthonic means, even though love it so much, but just chthonic refers to gods of the underworld, because chthonic means, like, of the earth, to my listeners, yeah.
Chthonos, yeah. All that good earthy stuff. So, yeah, I started thinking of this more sort of, like, spirity, like, presence Antigone tends to have through it, because one of the, like, interesting things is, like, Creon does go through this, like, very intense reversal at the end where he decides to release her and in fact at that moment starts spouting a lot of the similar rhetoric that Antigone was through the same actual philosophical lens. If anyone wants to look this up and wants more information about this, Antigone and Creon actually go along the lines, to get really nerdy for a second, of the pre-Socratic versus sophistic debates around the concepts of nomos, which are laws, and phusis, which are nature. And Megan Arp wrote an excellent dissertation going through all the different ways in which this philosophical debate plays out across throughout the play. Basically, there's, like, team pre-Socratics, which is, like, Antigone, Tiresias, Haemon, which are all about how these ideas of laws and nature are supposed to be interconnected, always sort of feeding into each other. One is supposed to inform the other. Whereas Creon seems to be sort of, like, captain of team sophist, which also, like, the guard is Mene, and the chorus at times, though the chorus goes through the arc as well. And sophists thought that nomos, laws, were supposed to actually, like, control nature and, like, order it and sort of, like, subjugate it, I guess, in different ways. And so the chorus really, like, emphasizes this in their first Stasimon, which is, like, one of the most famous songs from Greek tragedy. It's called the Ode to Man, because they're just, like, they talk about pola tadena, Many are the Dana, which is such a wild word. It means both like wondrous and horrifying. It's actually the root of a dinosaur, and of all things. And so they say, like, you know, Dana are like the things that man can do. So it's like wondrous, but also like horrifying, like all the things men can accomplish. And so you see after Creon decides to release Antigone, he has this switch where suddenly he starts defining these terms, like in this very pre-Socratic sense. And you're like, oh my God, wait, you've hopped sides in the philosophical debate. What's happening? And his last line actually is about like nomos. He's just like, I think I should live by like this definition of laws that I've been fighting against this whole time. Because the whole time he's like, I should define laws. I'm the ruler. And Antigone's like, no, certain laws like only the gods can define, especially around burial. And it's in that switch that he does that I actually started thinking about Antigone's impact more. And so I was wondering if there was a way in which she was actually haunting Creon in a very specific way. Because it's as he comes to this realization and decides to go free her, like, thematic, like in the play's like events, that is when she dies, and she has like died. And so I wonder almost like if there's a sense of these sort of ideas, all these things that she'd been trying to warm, to try to have these sort of premonitions about during her life, through her death she's actually able to then finally express them through Creon, actually reacting through all of these things. And so I became very obsessed with the idea of her prison being actually a stoma. So stoma in Greek is the word for mouth. It's actually where we get stomach from, which is like the bottom of like where we put things for our mouth. But stoma is also a word that's often used for just doorways, gateways, other things of that nature. And women, it was thought, had two stomas, in a sense. Thank you, Julia Sisa, and your book, Greek Virginity, for going into depth about that. Excellent book. Highly recommend. Where it was thought that, women had their second stoma of their reproductive organs. And it was like, wow, ancient gynecology is fascinating. They thought so many. It's wild. So basically, like, they thought that, like, your like lower mouth was like also for like eating in different ways, and that like, you know, there were like different types of like seals that it had, and it was actually thought that like virginity was like an imperfect seal, because like blood could still escape through menstruation, so they're just like, being pregnant is perfect, nothing is coming out of there, like it's so there I went through a lot of like ideas of just like, because I was like, right, women in prison. I'm just like, right, what did they think about women? I was like, I had to go through all these layers. And so, but it was really thought of these ideas that, these different types of mouths. They thought babies ate menstrual blood. So like, that's like why it had to stay up there, was like, it's like nourishment for like the baby to grow. And things.
Lovely.
I know. Yeah. But then I was like, wait.
Vampire babies.
Exactly. But then I was like, this is kind of like horrifying. And then I was like, wait. This is where things get weird, I won't lie. Like, I was just like, okay. If we think in different ways of like this prison that Antigone's in as this sort of like stoma, because it's also like Creon has been trying to control Antigone's stoma this entire like time, both from like her mouth of like what she's saying, because he's like, stop speaking. But then also like her reproductive system, because it's like supposed to, you know, engender his. And then he's like, no, absolutely not. And so I found it interesting that he sort of like put her in this like prison, and like in a way of giving her food that would like help like control like her mouth, of just like, haha, I do have power over you, in this sense. And it was actually on the food note that I came back to, because I was like, what an interesting, like, you know, Persephone parallel we do have here, because it's like, if she does eat the food, like she does sort of accept his power, his regime, all of these things, and so instead she does hang herself. But like, I do think it's interesting to note that, one, she's the only non-mother from Greek tragedy to hang mm-hmm. herself. It is really a strong maternal motif. Mm-hmm. But also her method of killing herself is literally closing up her throat and mouth for good, so that mm-hmm. nothing can actually go or like penetrate. And like, I mean, it closes up her second stoma, like one might argue, for good. Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking through like these gynecological metaphors around like haunting and like what her death was sort of doing in this way. Cause I was trying to picture the image of it, of like a cave and like her just hanging. And I was like, I guess that does remind me in ways of like a mouth with like the uvula in like the back hanging. Mm-hmm. And then you do have this like very intense sort of like outpouring of emotion that comes from this prison in different ways. Like, you know, you hear first like Haimon yelling from it and like sort of like echoing out this lamentation as he then is like holding on to like his wife or not wife. Mm-hmm. And then like, you know, you get violence as he tries to kill his father. But then like he also kills himself. So you get this like Creon has been trying to like control all of these like stomas to like a sense that now this like mouth womb like prison one is like almost in a way screaming at him, quite literally. Like it has turned into a mouth and now it is like undoing everything about like his own like his stoma and his like reproductive stoma. His son dies, his wife dies, there is like this outpouring of blood. So I thought of it in two ways where I was just like, like in one sense, it's like this stoma is like screaming. I'm like, in another, maybe more morbid sense that I ended up cutting from my thesis, because I felt kind of bad about it, was I was just like, it, I mean, Antigone's name against birth, it's almost right. Like she's sort of like miscarrying like her line, like in a way of just sort of being like, we got to get this all out. Like, Oedipus is dead, Jocasta is dead. Like, she names her whole family before she goes to die. And it's almost like she's sort of, like, wiping the slate clean of this, like, very intense, messy family and sort of, like, aborting, like, the whole line, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Except for Ismene, who walks mm-hmm. away somehow.
The last girl.
Yeah, the last girl doesn't.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, a lot of... when I was writing my thesis, I was very fascinated with this idea of Creon the entire time throughout the play trying to sort of physically control everything. And like so much of what angers him is that he can't really get to like Antigone's psyche and change her mind about like what she's saying, what she's doing. And so I think there, or at least what I wanted to argue, is that there's this interesting reversal in the end where it's like, yeah, it's because like, her psyche was then able to overtake him and then change the entire uh-huh. physical world around. And so I kept going back to like ghosts because I'm just like, yeah, maybe she just starts haunting him. Like
maybe she's
point.
Just haunting him. I like
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And so this was all like a big, long part of like my thesis that I ended up cutting just to focus more intensely on prisons because I was like, I have to be a philologist. Like I was like, I have to like focus just on the Greek and not get so fanciful. But now that I'm not in an institution anymore, just doing stuff on my own, I was like, hey, wait, that was actually a fun concept. So actually, in the week leading up to Halloween, I've actually broken up my master's thesis into 7 different sections that will hopefully be really fun to just sort of like explain this sort of entire saga of Antigone and haunting that I see throughout mm-hmm. the play. In different ways. Like, there's one section will look at the female body. There will be one that goes into, like, philosophy and the history of the prisons to give more, like, context. There's a whole section on music and going through stuff. And one section is, you know, Persephone, the proto-scream mm-hmm. queen of archaic myth, and how Persephone is the last goddess that Antigone invokes before she goes down Ooh. To the underworld. And specifically... Pharsae Fossa is the version.
Oh yeah,
the 5th century. There are so many different variants of Persephone.
Oh,
it's wild.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, Pharsae Fossa. That she's going down, you know, to live with the dead, to be living amongst the dead, which is something that Persephone also did. Had to go be living mm-hmm. amongst the dead. And right after she has this long speech, sort of invoking it, the chorus even says like, "Oh God, like, you know." The same, like, windy, like, you know, blowing, like, spirits, Suke, like, are, like, possessing, like, this girl. And so you're like, what? So I was like, possessing, all right. We're about to go into a haunting. It's happening.
She's haunted. Mm-hmm. She's possessed. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And another... Okay, this is goofy and silly. And, like, I need to say that before I make this point. And, so, as I mentioned earlier, you know, part of, like, Persephone's roles, like, she's also seen as, like, the mother often of Iacchus as a part of the Eleusinian Mysteries. Sometimes this plays interesting roles when it comes to how Iacchus shows up in choral lyrics, especially around Thebes. So, in Stasimon 5, which is right after Creon is like, I'm gonna go release her. Okay, bye. The chorus sings this, like, kind of, like, solemn, but, like, also kind of, like, hopeful, triumphant song to Dionysus, and they're just like, yo, a Theban boy, like, plague is coming, help us, like, you got this, Dionysus, we're gonna call you down, you're gonna be great. And I only bring this up is because, like, they talk about, like, you know, the different things he's known for, including grapes. So this is a goofy point, and I do keep needing to say that. But your uvula in the back of your throat, which is, for those who don't know, it's just the Latin word for little grape.
Oh!
And so I was actually, when I was originally writing this, I was trying to figure out what the, if there is, like, a Greek equivalent. I guess it is the same. Yeah. You just, like, it's the same, or they also call it, like, little grape. It's the staphule, like, the grape also. And so...
Huh.
They do talk about, like, the stuff, like, in the song right before they're like, and she's hung. I'm like a little grape, like a uvula.
Yeah.
That is a goofier point, but I just wanted to make the further connection. But also,
well, it's interesting, yeah.
Dionysus is such a god of, like, you know, mouths drinking as well, that I just feel like there's a lot of mouthiness in this play that I loved to explore. And ghosts. And it's just creepy, and I love it.
It is. And it's very interesting in that way. And yeah, what I was thinking, kind of, as soon as you started mentioning the haunting part, and I've not thought this all the way through, but I'm going to mention it to bring it full circle, is I'm getting real Scream 3 vibes.
Mm.
Where they introduce a ghost for no reason, and suddenly mm-hmm. you're dealing with some, like, real haunting stuff that doesn't really get resolved or make a lot of sense, and I love it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's very, like, you know, suddenly her mother starts haunting her to kind of, like, tell her something mm-hmm. about the ultimate story and the ultimate, you know, who is behind Ghostface in that one.
Yes. And I will say, ghosts are a motif on the attic stage. Like, people like that. Mm-hmm. Oh, the ghost of Agamemnon impacting, Orestes and Electra and trying to, you know, drive them to murder their mother is, like, one of the biggest ones that gets brought up a lot. But there is, this, like, sense of, like, spirits and, like, things coming back from the past and haunting. But also... Mm-hmm. In Antigone's, like, obsession with the chthonic gods throughout the play, there's just so many lines too about, like, Creon just being like, well, because you love, like, what's underground, like, it's time for you to go live underground and, like, do all these things. And then mm-hmm. the end, you know, everyone keeps talking about how Creon is, like, a living corpse now. So there is a lot of these, like, ideas of, like, reanimation, dead being where they're not supposed to be versus the alive being where they're not supposed to be, because it's like you have an unburied dead body and you're burying an alive body. So yeah, lots of good spooky stuff to talk about. Would also mm-hmm. be interested if anyone had a, like, zombie analysis in some of Greek tragedy too. I think there's definitely lots of room for that. Lots of blood drinking. I think, you know, vampire lenses are always appreciated.
The blood drinking scene in the Odyssey, like when he does that whole thing to get all the shades to come in, and they can't talk to him until they've drank the blood, and I love it.
See? Spooky classics. Love the spooky classics.
Oh my gosh, that's why I try to do spooky season every year, which you've helped me with this year, because I came from a holiday and was like, what am I going to do?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's so much, like, I will definitely say Cassandra's big, like, standout number in Agamemnon was, like, the first thing that got me thinking about this way back in undergrad, because that's so intense, and, like, yeah, also these ideas of, like, saying things plainly, and, like, people around you not being able to understand, I feel like is such an impactful theme in Greek tragedy that women go through a lot, specifically in different ways. Very literal.
It's very, it's very horror too. Yeah. The idea of Cassandra, right? Mm-hmm, like of, you know, the number of horror movies where specifically often women, you know, recognize that there's an issue and no one believes them or gaslights them or so many different things. Yeah. I mean, the Scream 2 plays with that very specifically by having Neve Campbell appear as Cassandra in like this fascinating, like completely invented version that seems to be a combination of so many plays. I love it.
It's so good. Yeah. I feel like that's also such a, why I always push back so hard on, I think people in positions of power often have a tendency to identify a lot with Creon. And they're just like, but also like people are being upstarts. And I always have to bring up a few different points. One, Creon literally has the power. He's the king. Like, I'm just like, guys, like you really are talking about these two, like the power differential is the same. And I'm like, and yet, especially when I hear professors talk about it, they tend to equate students and teachers. So, you know, I can see why they might do that. But two, actually the biggest point that I would like to bring up, and it's one that I think no one has actually paid that much attention to, but I think after this past year, people really might. Creon starts a plague. Like, there's a pandemic that actively affects his city and causes
And it's interesting, too, because, like, that's a full, like, an intentional mirroring of the plague that takes place in Oedipus that, you know, like, is the whole crux of that as well. Like, it, what it should do is be like an obvious reminder to Creon that, like, hey, the last time this happened, like, you were there, you watched, like, there was a pretty big problem, and, you know, and it wasn't, it was like 100% Oedipus's fault. And it's meant to kind of really mirror that, but then also Creon sort of is oblivious to it in a different way, or in the same way as Oedipus, rather.
And actually, that's where, like, I, like, actually weirdly love Creon as a character, is I'm, like, he's so obvious, like, taking on this, like, this, like, in the same way that, like, Antigone is, like, haunted by, like, her generational curse, like, the family he's from, he's doing, like, the same. I'm, like, Creon, you're Jocasta's brother, like, you know, you go through, like, a lot of the similar things, like, that are happening. But no, he, like, absolutely goes through, like, all this stuff that Oedipus goes through, and then the chorus, as he's going through it, are just like, damn, we guess Antigone's just like her dad. And it's, like, so ironic, because you're like, no, it's Creon.
Yeah, like, it's obviously Creon. Oh, that's, yeah, but that's really
also the events of the play are literally just him not listening. Like, he doesn't listen to Antigone. He doesn't listen to his son. And, like, he doesn't even listen to Tiresias. It's really just, like, it's finally when the chorus is, like, okay, maybe, damn. Maybe this is, like, the time. It's, like, he proves himself over the course of the play, like, what the fact that he is a bad leader by his actions throughout it. But also, like, he's the thing that I also remind people is, because they're like, well, like, it's his authority. Like, he can't have it challenged the way Antigone's challenging it. I'm like, he's been king for 12 hours, and his first ruling was to, like, literally go against Greek custom. Like, I'm just like, that's big. Like,
yeah, like, it's, you know, he's not a long-standing, he's not, he hasn't proven himself, like, there's so many things.
And then, like, his reasoning for it, like, before, you know, he figures out Antigone is doing stuff, he's just like, well, these are the laws by which I need to make Thebes great again, so we're doing it. And I'm like, oof, guys, this isn't great. This ain't great.
No. Much like something else.
And so, actually, I think it's for that reason, throughout the play, I think Sophocles, like, I think everyone's focused historically on, like, whether or not Antigone is right or wrong, like, whether the audience would have seen her as right or wrong. I'm like, okay, I actually think that's immaterial. I think Sophocles goes out of his way to illustrate how wrong Creon is and how much it makes him a bad leader. He spends the majority of the play trying to do that. So,
Oh, that's, and it doesn't necessarily mean Antigone is inherently right. It just means the point is that Creon
is wrong. Like, that, I think that is the point of Antigone, is that Creon is wrong. And that's why she's such a great character.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think if Creon had more ambiguity to his character, then like Antigone would be like a much more, like, I think the play would be a lot more muddled. But like, actually, I think it's in how clear, how wrong Sophocles goes out of his way to like every single episode since he steps on stage to be like, he's wrong, he's wrong, he's wrong. That makes Antigone so intense and impactful. But you know, scholars have been arguing about this play for millennia, and we probably will keep doing so.
I mean, isn't that the fun of all Greek tragedy, though? You know, everyone's got their different views on each one. And then, I mean, I love studying Greek tragedy because I also have an English degree. Like, I did a double major, and I feel like I connect to that part of it where it's a little more, it's a little easier to dive in and find your parts, your pieces, what you identify with, what you connect, like, yeah, the arguments you can make versus what are necessarily the arguments that Sophocles was trying to make, or history, or what have you, you know. Thank you so much for doing this. Oh my god, Scream Queens, that's so utterly fascinating, and I love the spooky shit so much.
And yeah, I was like, right, lots of ones in Greek tragedy, I think other ones in myth that are just like great. Like, and oh, I didn't even bring this up. God damn it. All of these gals, Antigone, Persephone, Cassandra in different times too. Io, though that's an interesting one since she turns into a cow. All the rest of these gals often get compared to birds too, like in how they like shriek, how they lament, how they mourn their youths. And it's actually in some other like bird myths too that we got some Scream Queens.
Procne and Philomela.
Absolutely. Two of the better Scream Queens that also get referenced. Even though our main myth of them comes from Ovid, actually in a lot of choral lyric from Euripides specifically, they tend to show up and just sort of make themselves that myth known. I think Heracles is the main one I'm thinking of, where the chorus is just like, oh god, parents killing their kids, it's bad, because Heracles kills his kids, and we're like, Oedipus, I also just think that, especially how much horror deals with all these like big intense aspects of social, cultural stuff, but also like plays with humor, plays with aesthetics, plays with like, you know, the drama of it all, with tropes in these like really intense ways. That's just why I think it's a really, really great lens to look at Greek tragedy in. And before I pop off, I do want to take note, in more recent years, quite a few horror films have actually been taking off of or directly referencing Greek tragedies. I first noticed this in Hereditary, the son in Hereditary, which has a great Scream Queen, Toni Collette. It's fascinating. Everyone go watch. In the son's high school class, they're reading Greek tragedies. And the first one they talk about is Trichiniae by Sophocles. And the second one they talk about is actually Iphigenia and Aulis. And it sort of like highlights the fact that like a lot of the kids in this film get sacrificed. But on the note of Iphigenia and Aulis, there was actually a horror film based off it by Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos, Killing of a Sacred Deer, which is...
I was just going to say.
Yeah, definitely a loose...
I wasn't sure if that was counted as a horror, but that's the one I always think
of. Oh, I count it, yeah.
I haven't seen it, so...
It's very unsettling. Yeah, it's definitely...
Yeah, I'm thinking of the trailer, and I remember thinking that it looked unsettling. Yeah,
one of my...
Which means why I usually don't watch
definitely
it.
One of my favorite Clytemnestras, Nicole Kidman playing. But it's very unsettling. But also just lots of more recent horror films have taken on a lot of just motifs that make them really, really easy to study and compare alongside Greek tragedy and myth. I know I've gotten a lot of mileage on Twitter out of both of Jordan Peele's films. I was able to compare Get Out to The Odyssey to show how it actually kind of inverts a lot of the Odyssey's narratives in fascinating ways. And then I actually looked at Euripides' choral lyrics, especially around his play Helen, and even Iphigenia a little bit, to look at his film Us, which deals with doubles and undergrounds and more chthonic fun things. I went into Persephone a bit with that one too. Yeah, everyone get more into horror, because tis the season, tis the month,
spooky season.
But also it's just like such a great way to like look at Greek tragedy, and like I would really love to see some good horror like interpretations of Greek tragedy. Like, where is our horror Bacchae film?
Oh my God. And Medea?
Medea, exactly. Oh my gosh. Oh, wait, my bad. Sorry. One more thing, forgot to plug. I just said Jordan Peele, and wow, I feel like an asshole for not bringing up the foremother of Black horror, not in the film area, in literature, Toni Morrison, who wrote a book called Beloved, which if folks haven't read it, it's very, it's straight horror. It's very, very intense. It's about, it's a basically Greek mythologizing of the life and experience of Margaret Garner, who was a Black woman who escaped slavery in the mid-1800s, and she ran away with her husband and children to the north. And then was actually caught by slave catchers, and so she killed her children, saying that it was better than them going back to slavery. And during the time period in the mid-1800s in America, that was actually the boom of what is now known as the golden age of classics in America. It was like the height of neoclassicism over here. People were really into it. So there was actually a painting done of her at the time that was dubbed the Modern Medea. An abolitionist really used her narrative to sort of be like, yo, see, slavery's bad. Like, we should, you know, free people. This was all in the, like, ramp up to the Civil War. Toni Morrison, who studied classics at Howard, took this narrative, but then also wove in more aspects of, like, the ancient myth of Medea to create this book called Beloved. That's all about sort of, like, the haunting of this, her Medea figure, as she sort of deals with the aftermath of slavery, of having to kill her one of her daughters, of and then her daughter actually coming back to haunt her, who she names Beloved, who the play is about, or the book is about. It's a very, very intense book. And actually, if you've just given birth, I would highly recommend not reading it. There are some very traumatic scenes around breastfeeding. It is one of the best horror narratives using Greek tragedy that I've ever witnessed or experienced. Wow. And there's very little literature from classicists on it. Shout out to Shelley Haley if we're writing about it and Euripides' Medea back in the 90s. We appreciate that.
That's funny. That book is sitting on my shelf and I've never read it, but I have it.
It's a lot. So it's very good. It's very, very good.
Well, I mean, where I know you.
No, I just keep talking because I love this subject.
No, I love it. Don't worry. But yeah, where can people find out a little bit more about you and find things? And then I'll let you go.
Yeah. So I'm Vanessa. You can find me either on Twitter at the Octobi Hole or over on Medium. I run an alternative classics publication called Corona Borealis. And this upcoming week, from the 25th through the 31st, I will be publishing my 7-part Antigone Unbound. So if you're interested in more of these themes around haunting and Greek tragedy and Persephone and what all this can mean, definitely swing by and read some of it. And there will also be a playlist the final day, too, to kick us off into October. And also I'll be trying to do this sort of fun, like, ghost haunting themed Antigone, going through the whole play playlist for folks. So
love it. I will link to all of, well, I can't link to the things that haven't existed yet, but we'll link to the overall website so people can find it on the episode's description.
Awesome.
Ooh, that sounds wonderful. Well, all right,
thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
thank you. Nerds, thank you all for listening. This was so much fun. I hope you enjoyed it. I mean, I think it's enjoyable even if you don't like modern horror. Still fascinating. But, you know, for those of you who are with me on an absurd love of Scream and the like, I hope you got an extra special appreciation out of this episode. So much fun. Next week with the conversation episode, we will be talking about witches. That is right. Oh my God. More spooky season. I fucking love it. It's so much fun. Thank you all so much for listening. Happy spooky season. So dorky. I am Liv and I love this shit.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together. We'll cry together and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. And I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.